What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode number 3 of Arc Junkies. I am your host, Jimmy McKnight. It is Monday, September 11th, 2017, and this episode is about welding overseas. My guest is a friend of mine named Rick Herman. Rick and I were roommates overseas in Kuwait. We both answered the call for a defense company to go over and build MRAP vehicles. And this was something at the time that, you know, after the attacks on 9/11, the defense industry really skyrocketed, and everybody's attitude to want to, you know, do their part to help the country was at an all-time high. And Rick and I, we answered that call. When we were offered the job to go overseas and help build these trucks to do our part, you know, we took it. We said, yes, absolutely. And for me, you know, I was actually denied entry into the service because I had an extraordinary amount, and I still have an extraordinary amount of tattoos. And so they turned me down. So when I was offered the job to still go over there and do my part and build these trucks, I took it. And when I met Rick, the adventure really just took off from this point. So this is a story of love, money, and sandstorms, and Rick tells it absolutely the best. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Rick Herman.
Pretty much, it was a job posting. It was a piece of paper that they put up on a bulletin board, you know, talking about the need to send, I think, 20 to 30 welders to Kuwait. It got everybody excited. You know, when it first came out, everybody in the shop, you know, they wanted to go.
Really? They weren't scared at all? They were like, oh, hey, we're going to go. Hell yeah.
I think, you know, because later on down the road, when more details came out, you know, a lot of people dropped off. They're like, that's not enough money. You know, it's really hard to find stuff on the internet about Kuwait. You know, is it really safe? You know, a lot of question marks. Mm-hmm. I know for me, we had been working overtime for a long time, you know, and I was making pretty good money. And then one day that just all came to an end. I think with defense contracting, you know, the money kind of being taken away from it.
What did you mean? You mean you were losing hours? You noticed your hours were starting to go down and things were starting to drop?
Oh, yeah. It went down to 40 hours and then it never came back up. Oh, so, wow. You know, they would just... You go from working, you know, a lot of overtime to none at all. Yeah. You know.
So then this comes around and it's like, oh, hey, you know, this might be our saving grace. We can go overseas and work.
Exactly. You know, I'm just making just enough money to pay all the bills. You know, what am I going to do next? And then this job come up. And, man, this looks like a pretty good opportunity.
When you went, when you decided to go over there and you started to go, I mean, what was the process that you went through to kind of head overseas?
I think they started taking resumes. They did a couple groups where, you know, a couple Q&As where, you know, you could ask some questions. You know, everybody pretty much wanted to know about the pay. It was kind of funny when they said, well, the pay is pretty much going to be what you're making right now plus a per diem, and that's when everybody was like, oh, hell no, you know, you don't get anything extra, you know.
Right.
And but you know, if you did the math on it, it was kind of gonna come out to probably around $130,000 a year.
That's not bad. That's a nice chunk of change.
Right. And mainly, you know, the money was there because the hours were there and they were guaranteed. And I know you remember spending a lot of long days at the shop with nothing to do. And even though we didn't have anything to do, we were still there for 12 hours no matter what.
Oh, but. Yeah. I remember that. I remember I got pictures of some of our extracurricular activities that we allegedly may or may not have taken place in during those times.
All right.
So when the pre-deployment happened, though, because personally I went through Camp Atterbury the second time that I went over. I went through Camp Atterbury, and I think we were there for like a week, and I just remember like it being like one of the most just a needle toe anticipating weeks of, especially, you know, like, all right, what's this going to be like? Like, we were already here, but, you know, this is a new experience. This isn't quite the war zone that Afghanistan was. This is more, you know, this is more laid back, and I'm hearing stories from everybody talking about what it's like over there, and, you know, you kind of can paint a picture in your head, but you have no idea. And then you're going through this week of Camp Atterbury where it's every day you have a new thing. And it was kind of chaotic, at least from what I remember, that, you know, it was, if you didn't make it to where you had to be at that point, at that time of day, then you didn't make it overseas. Like, you were gone. It was extremely strict.
Oh, right. You had a huge checklist. Yeah. You know, everything from body fat percentage to drug tests, to making sure you had every single shot, which was in the 20s, I believe. It was 20-some shots.
Yeah, it was a ridiculous amount of shots.
And, yeah, you had to have all your check marks or you didn't go. And in the group that I was in, there was quite a few people that didn't get to go and didn't make it.
Yeah, they got put on.
And, you know, they're slowly finding out through that week.
Yeah.
And it makes it stressful on everybody else because, you know, everybody's worked real hard to get there. They want to go. They've spent a lot of money. They're wanting to work and get that money back. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's like you said, you're on pins and needles, you know, just waiting on something silly to come up. I remember I had to fast for like 24 hours to have some blood work done.
Yeah.
Because they didn't like the first set of blood work or something. Had to fast for 24 hours, do the blood work again. You know, thank God it came back okay.
I remember they put us all in colors. Like, the groups were in colors.
Yeah, I remember being herded around like cattle. Like, okay, you go from here, now you got to go over here and stand in line. Get these shots. Then you got to go over here, get your blood pressure tested. You got to go over here, waiting pretty big long lines. Yeah, you know, well, it takes a whole week to get everything done.
Right. So, like, I remember it was like everybody was in color coded groups. And I remember, like, the orange group, I believe it was the one that was for people that weren't going to make it, or you weren't going to make it, so you were in orange, but it was like there was something where your blood work didn't work out or something wasn't there, or you didn't have something filled out, and that you were on orange team. And then it was like you saw, like, orange team slowly growing and growing as, like, the week went on with people that just didn't have their shit together for what they needed to get over, and some of it at no fault of their own. A lot of it was, you know, a company fault or even the previous medical office that they were's fault. You know, something was missed, because I noticed that when I was taking some of the military forms that I needed to get filled out, a lot of places never even saw those before. They were like, what is this? What kind of form is this? And they wanted to make sure every I was dotted, every T was crossed, because it was a military form.
Right. I remember going through that same stuff, man, and how nerve-wracking. Because, yeah, I remember I spent like a month going to different doctors getting shots just to be a little bit ahead of the game.
Yep.
Before going to Camp Atterbury, just so you didn't have to get all the shots right there at once, because, you know, some of them, man, they really made my arm sore.
Yeah, especially the one where they got to, like, stab you 15 times, I believe it is. It's like 15 or 16 times with that little needle that's got a, I think it's smallpox or something is what it is. And then you have to, like, have it bandaged, and you have to dress the bandage like every other day. And then, you know, they were like, don't let it touch any part of you, because then you'll get smallpox on that part of your body, blah, 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 blah. And it was like you're just walking around with this living virus that's healing on your arm for a week. It was creepy, man. I remember that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Some people had problems with theirs. Like, I remember some guys, man, their infection spot, it would, like, lump up real bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, like, look real disgusting. And I remember I kept mine bandaged for a long time. And then one day I just decided that it was time to take the bandage off. And, you know, took the bandage off and let air get to it. It started, you know, healing up after that. But, oh, man. I remember some gross ones.
When you were in Camp Atterbury, did you guys have your kind of like last night send off at the All Ranks Club they had there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
You remember all the dollar bills from, or just like it was all kind of different denominations that they had, like, all over that place, like hanging from the ceilings. There was all kinds of bills from every different part of the world, from soldiers and contractors that were coming through there. They put them up on the ceilings and stuff.
Yeah, super cool thing to see, man.
Yeah, that was kind of the icing on the cake. It was like, wow, like this is the hub. Like we are getting ready to travel. I mean, who would have thought, you know, putting the hood down, you know, just before this? Because before I went overseas and welded for military, all I had done was just I was rack welding, man. I was in the automotive industry, just making material handling racks at very low wage for, you know, very, very overworked and underpaid scenario for a long time. And then out of nowhere, I got this opportunity to go overseas. And so when it came down to like the point where you are actually, you know, you're flying the next day, that moment before it all kind of hits you where you're just like, I'm ready to do this. I have no idea what I'm about to do, but I'm ready to do this.
No doubt. I remember I was nervous, like saying goodbye to my family and everything, you know, then going to Camp Atterbury. And then, you know, the nerves kind of relaxed. And then I was nervous right before we got on that long airplane ride.
Right.
So I think we probably went from Indianapolis airport to somewhere in Washington Dulles, I think.
Yep.
And then Washington Dulles to Kuwait was the long one. That's like 13 or 14 hours, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was nervous right before getting on that plane, like, what am I going to do for 13 hours? You know, I know it's going to be hard to sleep. It's going to be hard to just sit there.
Yeah, the first time that I went, and I noticed it when I was on when I went to Afghanistan the first time, you know, and it brought what you were just saying made me think about it, you know, like the nervousness of getting ready to go over there. It was once you get over there, you know, you find out real quick, man, that if you do not have everything in line that you need before you head over there, that it doesn't go away. You don't leave your problems behind. Like those problems come with you. And, you know, I found that out the first time I went to Afghanistan. I was in Afghanistan, you know, for like 3 months. And because of all the things that I left unattended at my house, it all just, you know, it all creeped up and followed me. And it caused such a problem that I actually had to cancel my contract early, go home and take care of, you know, a whole bunch of family issues that would have, you know, ended up destroying my family and losing my home and everything else. So I had to come back and take care of that. And luckily, within a month or two after that, I was able to get the contract in Kuwait and then, you know, finally head over and actually kind of, you know, enjoy the whole experience for what it was versus leaving unprepared.
Oh, man. Yeah, no doubt, man. That had to be driving you crazy.
Oh, it was, because, I mean, you're 10,000 miles or, you know, however many miles away, not 10,000, like more like 110,000 miles away. And it's like, you know, you don't even know. There's nothing you can do about any of those problems. There's nothing you can do about it. And you know, guys that are in the military, you know, my heart completely goes out to them because they can't go back. There's nothing they can do, you know, to go back and take care of things. Where us as contractors had the liberty to where we could go back and take care of what we needed to, you know, if we had to. And, you know, like I said, luckily I went back, I took care of everything I needed to, everything was good. And then I got the call again from the same company. Hey, you ready to come back? I'm like, hell yeah. I had to go through pre-deployment again and then ended up in Kuwait. And then that's where I met you. And then the adventure began.
Hell yeah. Oh man, I had a roommate for a while, and like the same scenario that you just described. He was having problems at home, and it was eating him up every day.
Yep.
And eventually, he said, I've got enough money now. You know, I'm going home.
Yeah.
And so then I didn't have a roommate for a long time, which was kind of nice. And then I heard, you got a roommate coming. I'm thinking, oh, great. Yeah. Who's this guy going to be? Where is he going to be from? You know, there's no telling. Thank God it was you. Yeah. Cool dude. Extremely cool dude.
I remember, thanks, man. I remember opening up the door and you were like, what's up, man? My name's Rick. I'm never here. And this is pretty much the place. I was like, yeah. All right, cool. This is going to work.
Yeah. Cause actually, I think at that point, I actually had another apartment that my wife was staying in.
Yeah.
Because she wasn't allowed to stay at the company apartment, you know, because it was really, really tiny. two-bedroom apartments that you had to share, you know, with another guy. You wasn't allowed to have, you know, live-in girlfriends or, you know, live-in wives or anything like that.
Well, not just that. It was completely illegal over there. And we'll put a fork in that. I want to come back to that later. We were working on MRAPs over there. And, I mean, we were putting in, like, what, 11-hour days, 6 days a week. And then afterwards, going to the gym and then, I mean, doing it all over again. It was like that was you just kind of fell into the routine of this is what we're doing. And I remember we were replacing the floors in these things.
Yeah. We was putting a one piece floor in, and it was actually a part of the truck where they had a lot of problems with the floor buckling and soldiers getting hurt. But yeah, man, long days. It was 12-hour days. And remember, we had an hour lunch that we didn't get paid for.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So
we was there on base for 13 hours. And then the bus ride there was about 45 minutes. The bus ride home was about 45 minutes. And then every now and then there'd be like traffic problems and it could take, you know, an hour or a little more.
I remember being there and we're all working and then a sandstorm kicking in so bad that sand is starting to come into the shop that we're working at. I mean, so bad to where we had to like cancel and everyone's like, all right, pack up. We're going home early. Sandstorm's coming in. It's too bad. We can't work. And like the mentality was like, all right, we got to wait for the general to make the ultimate call. He's going to make the ultimate call because like everybody else was like, we're working through it. I mean, you could barely see. We're working through it. It was crazy.
That actually stems from a couple of months after I landed in Kuwait. We had a horrible sandstorm. And like nobody seen it coming, nobody was prepared for it, and it just hit us like a ton of bricks. And you know, we didn't get out of work on time, you know, so we was actually stuck at work, and we was stuck at work till like 11 or 12 at night because the sandstorm hit, and then it was just too bad to be able to drive in it. The visibility was just too bad, so. Yeah, everybody had their dust masks on. We're just hanging out, you know, waiting to be told that we can go home, you know, in our little buses. Yeah. And even then, I can remember leaving out there in them little buses, man, and the visibility just being
horrible.
Nothing.
And this eerie orange. It was this eerie orange, man, that like that color is not identifiable anywhere else than a thick-ass sandstorm straight up.
You know, getting home back here, you know, in Ohio, that's the first thing that I noticed, man. I get off the plane and I look up and green. I see a clear blue sky. And I was like, holy shit. Yeah. You know, how long has it been since I looked up and seen a blue sky like that? Because you don't see blue skies over there. No. You just don't.
No, it's not. Yeah, you're right. It's not there. Not till you're getting way out in the ocean, you know. I remember when the sandstorms would hit up so hard, man, like we'd have to go out and blow off the Lincolns that we were using, the Lincoln welders, like they would just be covered with sand. And like we actually fabricated some exhaust covers. You remember we fabricated like flapping exhaust covers to put over them just to help keep the sand out because it was blowing all over the place so bad.
Yeah, man, that trip actually kind of made it to where I don't really like Lincoln welders anymore because we was really hard on them. I mean, I give them a little bit of credit. We was extremely hard on them and like, we didn't even change the oil in them when they needed to be changed. At first the generators, they started off in the building and then safety decided it was like too much fumes.
Yeah.
They decided they wanted us to move them outside the building. And then, you know, we cut little holes in the bricks and ran our wires inside the building, you know, just to eliminate, you know, some of the fumes and some of the heat off the, you know, running generators. But, yeah, it put them out there in harm's way after that, man. They were in the sand and the dust. And we had quite a few of them just lock up on us and completely, you know, done. Order another one.
Yeah, I don't think they were. I don't think they were designed for those kind of conditions. I'm just putting that out there. Right. I think for what we had though, and the conditions we were, I think the Lincolns did a pretty good job, man.
We was running the crap out of them. Hell we yeah. were running 045 hardwire. You know, running an extremely high. I won't say extremely high, but a pretty high voltage.
Yep.
And amperage. Definitely up in the 20s.
Probably what, a 15-foot triple pass we had to do on each side, and then put the gussets on that required, I want to say it was like a 7/8 bead all the way across at 1 foot lengths.
Yeah, man, it was a lot of welding.
That was crazy. Yeah, I remember. And we all had 3M speed glass air cool packs, which was nice because we were in the enclosed area. And that was one thing I noticed too, man, because even how hot it got over there, like I remember the one day we clocked it was like 125 of pure just sun power, and we were dying. But like with those air hoods on, as long as your face was cold, the rest of you could just be pouring sweat, but you were just sitting there working, no problem, as long as your face was cold.
Right. It makes it better. Yeah. That air around your face makes it better. Right. For sure.
So, I mean, we fell into routine there. I mean, we're getting up early, we're getting on the bus, we're going to work, we're building the trucks, we're getting on the bus again, we're heading home, we're going to the gym. And then, you know, we also found ourselves in other extracurricular activities, and they weren't exactly ones that were, I mean, you could say were legal in that country, right? We found out that, for those that are listening that don't know, Kuwait has very strict laws when it comes to bachelors and women. And when you're a guy, like, you're not even allowed to be in the same room alone with a woman unless you're married. At least from what we were told, and that's how strict it was. They were like, you stay away from girls. You don't do this. You don't do that. I mean, am I wrong? They were like really strict with the rules on who we could associate with over there.
Yeah, like when I went through, same thing, man. The training was, you know, you are not, and not even, you know, you're not allowed to be alone in a room with a woman that's not your wife.
That's what it was. Yeah. Yeah. You're not allowed to be in a room alone with a woman that's not your wife.
Right. Uh-oh.
Yeah, that was crazy. I mean, especially for us, you know, I mean, we're two single dudes at the time, you know, we're in a foreign land. This is craziness. But you kind of found yourself in a little bit of a predicament, and this was something that you were already in when I showed up. And I want to touch onto this because, you ended up finding somebody while you were over there. You found yourself a girl, and it blossomed into way more than that. It blossomed into a kid and a wife. So let's get into that story.
Man, dude. Yeah, she's met her, man. She's the greatest thing that ever happened to me and made me not even care that I was breaking the law.
Hell yeah. Love will do that, man. That's crazy. So, let's get into that. You're just a dude, you're working, you're doing your thing. And then, how did you meet your wife over there?
She was actually working at a car rental place, and I don't know. I think we was probably in Kuwait 4 or 5 months, and they started getting our driver's license finished. You know, we didn't have our passports for a long time. They had our passports, getting our IDs made and stuff. And we got those back. And then shortly after that, we started getting our driver's license. Well, when people started getting their driver's license, renting a car, you know, started becoming a really good idea, you know, not having to ride on that bus every day that's, you know, shoulder to shoulder with grown men. I think these buses were probably designed for much smaller people.
I would agree. Yeah, I would agree. They weren't designed for a bunch of overeating Americans when we showed up. That's for sure, man.
Right. We worked them buses hard. But in the process of getting my license and wanting to rent a car, you know, trying to find the cheapest prices, I ended up at this one car rental place to look at a car to rent, and there she was. She was working there. love at first sight, no doubt.
So, like, how did you even approach that situation? Did you like keep going and then renting the same, you know, car at the same place over and over till you worked up enough courage to talk to her, or how did that happen?
No, I got a number right away. Like, I was like, this is like sink or swim.
Wasted no time. You're like, this
wasted. Yeah, wasted no time.
Right. So things start blossoming, obviously. And then, you know, you find out that she's pregnant. What do you do when you're in a country where, A, that's completely illegal, and B, you are there and you have to be there for a little while? How do you even deal with something like that?
Yeah, you gotta hide it. You gotta straight up hide it. And we did a good job of that for a long time. She was still going to work every day. I was going to work every day. We were still, it was like doing our shopping together and stuff. You know, because it takes a while before, you know, they really start showing really good.
Right, but then when they start showing,
I remember when she did start showing, you know, to where she couldn't hide it like at work anymore. And I immediately had, when that day came, I immediately had her quit her job, because I kind of thought that's, if we got in trouble, that's probably where it would happen at. It would happen with her work, you know, someone yep. noticing, telling somebody else. So, you know, I had her quit her job before that ever happened.
So then you had to go into this whole secrecy thing where now you're just a regular blue collar welding guy working abroad in another country. You've got a girl in an apartment that's off site from your regular apartment that you're hiding all this stuff, trying to do the right thing by her too, you know, and now, you know, what happens now? Because how did you even continue when, you know, like doctor's appointments and things like that? How were you able to keep that hidden and still like do normal checkups, and were you even able to do checkups like that?
Good question, man. And yes, we were. We actually found a Filipino doctor that, you know, was understanding of the situation and probably sees a bunch of people in the same situation. So, you know, had we went to like a regular hospital or a regular doctor, that could have been another place where we could have ran into problems. You know, they could have wanted to see, you know, marriage certificate or whatever, you know, proving that this is your wife and she's here and she's pregnant. So, yeah, finding a Filipino doctor definitely saved us. So we didn't have to go without checkups and stuff.
Right. And like, what would the consequences have been if you would have been caught?
Good question, man. I don't really know 100% for sure. Maybe a fine to pay, maybe deportation, you know, and fines. You know, I don't think that I would have been in trouble. It would have been her in trouble. You know, she's violated her visa or her terms of her visa, saying, you know, that says that she's not allowed to get pregnant while working in Kuwait.
And so, like, now she would have been the one that, I mean, she could have even have gotten jail time for this, right?
Yeah, potentially. I definitely wouldn't rule it out.
Yeah, that's crazy, man. I mean, and that's like some of the things that, you know, you really got to take into consideration when you work abroad and you're actually, you know, leaving the comforts of your own home and your own country, you know, for the money that is money that you wouldn't have been able to make here, guaranteed. Like, the money that we made overseas is, we would have not been able to make here. There's no way, you know what I'm saying? Unless you're just a way higher up person, not as an average guy coming in and punching a clock.
So, right. No. Yeah, no doubt.
I mean, you really got to take into consideration where you're going. You take in the pros and cons and make sure that if you are going to a place to make some extra money, you follow their rules, or at least, you know, have your ass covered one way or another. Because as you found out, you know, the risk was extremely, extremely high for the situation that you got into just being a regular guy, a regular American guy in a foreign land.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, you know, you definitely don't want to get in trouble and be on one of them shows like Locked Up Abroad.
Oh, shit. Right.
And, you know, you definitely don't want to get in trouble and lose your job, you know, because you're making a lot of money. You definitely don't want it to come to an end.
Right.
But yeah, it was real strict, man. And it just, I guess it all comes back to the Muslim, you know, religion. You know, we was there under an army rule that was called General Order Number 1. You know, to make a long story short, it's pretty much, you know, no drinking, no smoking, no sex, It goes on and on. I'm blanking out, but I know there's not a lot more rules than that. But it's pretty much like you couldn't do anything out of the ordinary. But
I remember they would search our rooms too. I remember they searched our rooms. When we came back, like it was everybody was in the lobby, and then the actual higher ups of the company walked you up and searched your room to make sure that you didn't have any booze, you didn't have any drugs. A lot of guys over there were, you know, shooting up steroids. It was almost like they were doing whatever they could. You know, I mean, as people do, you don't see the boom in North Dakota take off and then, you know, prostitution and drug use and everything else skyrocket for no reason. I mean, people go to what, you know, it's just a thing that people do, really.
Right. Yeah. A couple guys got caught with, the bootleg liquor, you know, there was a few guys got caught with steroids, and it's like, man, such a tragedy. You know, when you're making good money like that and
all gets,
you know, it's like the company that you work for is out to get you a little bit, you know, and if you mess up just a little bit, you know, they'd have you. But, you know, one of our good friends, they actually found some alcohol in his refrigerator. And still to this day, man, he swears up and down that it wasn't his and it was his roommate's. Well, when they got caught, his roommate said it wasn't his. So, you know, you got two guys, you know, with alcohol in the kitchen, which is a, you know, common place of the apartment that both people use. And so they had to fire them both, of course. Nobody ended up fessing up. They fired both guys. And I was just sick for that guy, losing his job over that.
Yep. I remember that. So now, I mean, you obviously things worked out, you know, for you and the baby and all of that kind of stuff. You got her home and you guys got married and you're living life happily ever after now.
Absolutely. Yeah. When she got to where she couldn't hide her pregnancy anymore in Kuwait, she went back home with her family in the Philippines. And it just happened to be perfect timing, man. My contract ended in Kuwait about a month before my baby was due. So I left out of Kuwait. I came back to Ohio for about 2 weeks just to visit the family. And then I flew out to the Philippines where I stayed for about 5 months, you know, for my daughter to be born, for, you know, passports to get made. And it took about 5 months to get everything done before us three could, you know, fly back to Ohio as a family, you know, get back to the American dream.
Right. And you were just, now that you guys have got back, and I mean, it's absolutely crazy story. You know, I don't think a lot of people, you know, realize how crazy it can really get, you know, once you take an adventure like that. Honestly, I mean, your whole life changed because of that.
Oh, absolutely, man. It was, being in Kuwait was a life experience. Being in the Philippines after that was a life changing experience, man. Wouldn't trade it for anything. I probably won't go back to see any places in the Middle East, but I'll definitely be going back to the Philippines as much as I can. I mean, that place is just awesome.
Hell yeah, man. Well, Rick, dude, I want to thank you very much for coming on the show and sharing your story. I think people can really, you know, get an eye-opening experience, you know, from that. So thank you for coming on the show and sharing your story. I appreciate your time.
Hey, thanks for having me, man. It's a pleasure, man. Your show, man, it's going to be good. It's going to be real good.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it. Appreciate the support. All right, everybody, thank you so very much for listening. That is it for this week. Until next week, remember to go on iTunes and subscribe and leave a review. Your reviews help us on our rankings. Also, you can email the show, arcjunkies@gmail.com. I want to hear from you, and I want your feedback. Go to www.arcjunkies.com, and you can check out the backlog of every episode. And remember, brand new episodes every single Monday. Again, thank you very much for listening, and until next week, weld hard.